From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout the war in Iraq, debate has raged over our government's real reason for invading that country. But when it comes to Israel's campaign in Lebanon, the controversy has been about tactics. Few would dispute what it is Israel is trying to do, secure its borders by wiping out Hezbollah once and for all. Israeli officials invoked that goal again last week when their warplanes took out two TV towers containing transmitters for the popular Lebanese stations LBC and Future TV. The Israelis said they also contained relay stations for the Hezbollah station Al-Manar, as well as critical infrastructure for cell phone communications by the guerrillas. It's hardly the first time media have been caught up in the fighting, but this marks a new phase, says Lawrence Pintack, director of the Adams Center for Electronic Journalism at the American University in Cairo. Pintack was a Middle East correspondent for CBS back in the 80s and sees what he calls a new weaponization of media. That is, media used both as a target and as a weapon.
What has changed in recent years, and this really goes back to the years after 9/11, is that while it has always been dangerous for reporters to be in combat situations, while television stations run by quote-unquote enemy agents have always been fair game, what has changed is that reporters, individual reporters, are being directly targeted both by governments and by insurgents of all stripes.
Give us a for instance in the current conflict.
You look at the fact that the Al Jazeera correspondent, and Al Jazeera parenthetically has always operated very freely in Israel, but the Al Jazeera correspondent has been twice detained by Israelis. An Al Jazeera cameraman was wounded in Gaza. I mean, this certainly goes right back to the U.S. attack on Al Jazeera in Kabul, which initially was said to be a mistake, but later came out it was actually targeted.
Where did that come out? Because the U.S. military is not admitting that.
Well, the U.S. military in Kabul initially said it was a mistake. Then they said that it was going after a specific al-Qaeda individual, and we got him. Then a few weeks later, they announced they got the guy somewhere else later. Mm. And then in a recent book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author about the secret war, he quotes CIA officials as saying that after the bombing, there was great relief at CIA headquarters and in the White House that they had sent, quote, a message to Al Jazeera.
You're quoting from Ron Susskind's book, The 1% Doctrine.
Correct.
So why then the change? Does it reflect the growing importance of information, especially of TV?
I think it reflects two things. One is the power of satellite television. If we look at the Middle East, until Al Jazeera came along, the idea of television journalism was an oxymoron. So suddenly you had semi-independent, let's say, journalism going on. Then at the same time, media on both sides, in my view, have weaponized themselves. The American media was waving the flag. The Arab media was taking a mirror image approach to the conflict. And each lost this, at least, facade of independence and objectivity. Go back 20 years to Lebanon. We as journalists could quite literally spend the morning in the bunkers with Hezbollah and the Shia who were facing the U.S. Marines and spend the afternoon in the bunkers with the U.S. Marines facing Hezbollah. And everyone accepted the fact that we were doing that because we were semi-independent anyway, reporters. Now we are seen as representing American policy, supporting American policy. So the next logical step would be, well, if we go into the bunkers with Hezbollah, we're going to go back and report to the Marines where Hezbollah is, which is something that everybody knew that we didn't do. So that has dramatically affected how reporters can move around, how reporters can function.
How much of a problem do you think last week's airstrikes really created for the TV networks that were hit? I mean, aren't they mostly distributed by satellite? Weren't they back up on the air pretty soon?
This is the irony, and it underscores the fact that at a certain level, governments still don't get the idea that you can't stop this flow of information. But it is possible to have a dramatic impact on how the media can cover a conflict. On both sides, we're not hearing this, but on both sides, reporters are operating under severe constraints. In Israel, they're operating under military censorship. In Lebanon, all journalists are pretty much at the mercy of Hezbollah to be brought around to places to be safe as they get to those places to see the things that Hezbollah wants them to see and perhaps not see the things that Hezbollah doesn't want them to see.
Do you think that the spin has gotten more sophisticated now, too? The journalists are being used more effectively by various sides in the current conflict?
Yes, I think everyone is getting more and more media savvy. Now, that doesn't mean that they weren't years ago. I look back at Hezbollah's role and Amal's role in the TWA hijacking back in the mid-80s that I covered. It was carefully crafted. It was carefully manipulated with ABC being given access to the American hostages at seafront restaurants, all looking wonderful and happy and comfortable. Day to day, they dragged out the story. They made sure that we were fed bits and pieces. But now everyone is media savvy. Look at what's happening in Iraq. One of the reasons that even the Arab media can't operate very effectively in Iraq is that the insurgents have set up their own media operations. They are shooting their own footage. They are doing post-production. They are putting out press releases. They are handing these packages to foreign news organizations saying, this is what you have to use, which again is why journalists are being attacked who try to report independently.
Lawrence, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Lawrence Pintak is the author of Reflections in a Bloodshot Lens, America, Islam, and the War of Ideas. He spoke to us from the Sonoma Valley.
Last week, we devoted most of the program to the media coverage of the conflict in the Middle East, and as usually happens, especially with this story, we received a number of letters charging us, and pretty much all media, with bias. The fact is, they're all probably right. Intentionally or not, journalists use inflected language, exclude historical context, and view events through the prisms of their own experience, incensing those with other worldviews. Indeed, a story in the Washington Post this week revisits research concluding that people with deep convictions tend to be the ones who write letters and are more likely to perceive bias. Viewing the same piece, the best-informed partisans coming from opposite sides will see bias against them and worry about the impact of bias on the less informed. Shankar Vedantam wrote the piece for the Washington Post, and he joins us now from Cambridge, England. Shankar, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Bob. Glad to be here.
So who did this study, and what was the methodology?
Well, the study actually goes back a ways. It was conducted after Israel's last invasion of Lebanon in 1982 by psychologists at Stanford University. And it was a very unusual and interesting methodology. It just showed six television clips of the conflict to 144 observers, some of whom were pro-Israeli and some of whom were pro-Arab and some of whom were neutral. And pro-Israelis found that the clips had an astonishing number of anti-Israel references. And the pro-Arabs found the very same clips had a huge number of anti-Arab references. So partisans were able to look at the exact same clips and draw diametrically opposing conclusions about them.
Now, you might think that being steeped into a subject would lend itself to nuance of understanding and sympathy for other people's views, but it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, this is pretty troubling because what the researchers assumed when they started the study was that the more informed people were about the conflict, both pro-Israeli and pro-Arab, the less likely they would have these stark differences in perception. As it turned out, it was exactly the opposite. The more informed people were, the more likely their assessments of the television news clips were diametrically opposing. And the interesting thing is that what's animating this difference in perception is the fear among both pro-Israelis and pro-Arabs that neutrals will gravitate to the other side. And the data shows that in this, they're actually misguided.
What does the study show about neutrals and how they process attempts at objective journalism?
Well, neutrals seem to process journalism very differently than partisans. I suppose, in general, neutrals are first more likely to be uninterested in the issue, so they may not be paying attention at all. But when they do pay attention, they're far more able to pick up the strengths and weaknesses of both sides' positions. And so the fear that partisans have that neutrals will, in effect, defect to the other side is fundamentally unfounded. But the anxiety and the fear about that is extremely real. And the psychologists believe it is that fear which essentially leads to this war of perceptions.
Now, you seem to be describing a form of condescension. I mean, because they understand the history, the context, the arguments so acutely, they fear for how biased reporting misleads the poor, everybody else.
Right. I mean, so what happens is when journalists cover daily news events, what they do is they write about, you know, whatever happened the previous day. And what partisans want is they want far more than just what happened the previous day. They want all of the context, and usually the context that they want is somewhat selective, but they want the context that essentially justifies whatever happened the previous day from their point of view.
Well, let's think of an example of how attempts by the media to be even-handed are futile. Since the Israeli incursion into Lebanon, almost every lead of every story includes the number of casualties, which are tenfold as numerous in Lebanon as they are in Israel. Now, the statistic is usually cited without further comment, but if you believe that, for example, that Israel has the right to defend itself from rocket attacks, and you believe that that requires the dismantling of Hezbollah, and if you believe that Hezbollah shields itself in civilian populations, a simple body count like that sounds like anti-Israeli propaganda.
That's exactly.
And if you believe that Israel is oppressive and disproportionately brutal, the word incursion itself looks like a euphemism for invasion.
That's exactly.
How is any reporter supposed to negotiate that minefield?
So long as reporters are trying to describe both sides, it is inevitable that they're going to run into conflict with both sides. And one of the ironic things when these conflicts break out is pretty much the only thing that partisans on both sides will agree on is that the media is biased against them.
So even if every story on the Mideast were accompanied by historical context in 8 volumes, the partisans would never be mollified.
I think so, because I think context for an Israeli is something different than context for an Arab, precisely in the way that you just laid out. So the reasons people come to particular points of view is that they are aware of, you know, the historical context, and they are aware of all of the things that might have led up to that particular moment in the conflict. The person on the other side has a whole litany of events that lead up to their own perception of whatever happened yesterday.
Okay, Shankar, well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
Shankar Vedantam is a staff science writer for The Washington Post.
Coming up, watching the war on YouTube and journalistic blackmail through the ages.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the last 2 weeks, we've looked closely at how the war in Israel and Lebanon has been covered by press around the world in newspapers and on broadcast cable and satellite television. This week, we logged onto YouTube.com, one of the major hubs for citizen video, to see what was happening at the intersection of the digital revolution and breaking news. The answer is, journalistically, not much. That, with 309,000-some views, is from the most-watched video under the search term Lebanon. It's a grainy, static shot of Beirut's sky at night with two distant bomb flashes, more like a thunderstorm than a siege. This is a surprise. The 2004 tsunami yielded breathtaking footage from tourist camcorders of whole villages being consumed in the tidal surge. Last year, the London subway bombings were reported within minutes via cell phone cameras. Surely more than 2 weeks of war would produce pictures worth thousands of words. Dead bodies, panicked innocents, radicalized civilians vowing revenge. But there are very few. When it comes to the wholesale reinvention of spot journalism, this time around, the nascent vlogosphere has come up pretty much empty-handed. But wait, it may be we were looking for the wrong thing.
I want to talk again about Israel and Syria and Palestine. I just want people to know and to tell me why that keeps happening. What's up?
That's another of the most viewed video posts from this crisis. A young man posed in front of an olive green drape, gently suing for peace. Simplistic? Naive? Maybe. But this man's sincerity struck a nerve. Nearly 200,000 people have viewed Peace Guy, and 4,000 of them were moved to post comments, just as 4,000 commented on the static shot of the Beirut skyline. Because the vlogosphere is not just a bunch of amateurs trading videos, it's a sort of living organism with the human quality of self-awareness. Within a day of the original peace video, another one popped up. Same guy, same olive drape, same vaguely Middle Eastern accent.
Israel, the Jew, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, the Muslim. Please stop.
Except it wasn't the same guy, it was a different guy doing a spoof of the peace video. I'll leave off the punchline on the grounds of vulgarity, but the joke isn't the point. The point is that journalism is not the only means for processing traumatic events. There is also the rest of mass culture. And to surf YouTube is to see the cultural conversation, like time-lapse pictures of a fetus in the womb, gestate before our eyes.
The legal landscape is still feeling the aftershocks of the disclosure last December of a vast National Security Agency domestic wiretapping program. More than 20 lawsuits have been working their way through the courts, and the government has often defended itself with the most reliable weapon in its arsenal, the state secrets privilege. Essentially, that's when the government claims that it would have to reveal state secrets if the case went to trial. That handy tactic has shut down many, many cases against the government since 9/11. So it came as a surprise last week when a San Francisco judge rejected the state secrets privilege and ruled that a case against the government and AT&T related to NSA wiretapping could go forward. Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University and a lead counsel in a federal case looking into the NSA program. He says that until now, the state secrets privilege has served the government as an almost impenetrable shield from legal scrutiny, wielded in ways its creators never intended.
You know, the Supreme Court said that not all classified matters should be subject to this privilege. This was supposed to be a very exceptional thing to dismiss a case on this basis.
Now, a case was dismissed in Chicago on Tuesday because of the state secrets privilege. But surprisingly, as we mentioned, the privilege didn't work in San Francisco. So what happened?
It really was the factor of the judges. You have a judge in San Francisco that said, look, I just don't buy your argument that simply forcing these telecom companies to confirm or deny whether they gave you a lot of information would bring the republic to its knees. The judge in Chicago adopted a much more deferential view to the government and, frankly, a view that's more consistent with other courts. He just simply said, look, I have this declaration that says that national security would be injured. He seemed to indicate that he wasn't quite confident of that, but said that he had to go along with what the administration said.
So let's talk about another case, the Supreme Court decision on Hamdan, which found that the government did not have the right to try Guantanamo detainees in secret military tribunals. You say that this decision has the effect of bolstering all the cases now pending against the NSA wiretapping program. Why?
Well, the administration has been arguing for years now that when they were given authority by Congress after 9/11 to go after the perpetrators of that, that it gave the president absolute authority in eavesdropping and handling of detainees and enemy combatants. And many of us have questioned that and said, that's just not the case. This is a very narrowly defined resolution. And in fact, the senators rejected broader language. Well, it still gave them an argument. They could say people can disagree, but this is the authority that we believe is clear. Well, the Supreme Court rejected that and refused to read into it this type of broad authority. Now, when it did that in Hamdan, it virtually cut away the legal claims used to defend the NSA operation. Now, what that means is hard to overstate because some of us believe that the president committed a federal crime when he ordered not once but 30 times the renewal of this program.
So into this patchwork of legal cases working their way through our courts enters Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said in an op-ed in Monday's Washington Post that the surveillance program was, quote, a festering sore on our body politic, and said that he held fierce, torturous negotiations with the president and came out with a major breakthrough. You don't think so?
The Specter-Cheney compromise would remove these cases challenging the NSA operation to a secret court called the FISA court. This secret court was designed to approve warrants for searches. It's like taking Marbury versus Madison and sending it to a traffic court. It is absolutely preposterous to send a massive constitutional case to that court where opposing counsel is not allowed in the courtroom. So the government doesn't have any opposing counsel. If the government wins, no one can take an appeal. And moreover, Specter would allow the government unlimited chances to tweak the program until it passes review in the secret proceeding.
But Specter's justification, as I read it, is that if all these cases were to proceed in court, the government would invoke things like the state secrets privilege, and basically they would be shut down anyway. So at least this way, the president has a place where he can feel comfortable being scrutinized.
Well, the problem with Specter's defense is that this is a case where this so-called do-nothing Congress actually should do nothing, because you have various cases that are very close to a final opinion on the legality of the NSA operation. What the White House, what they fear, is that now that the Supreme Court cut away their legal authority, they may be looking at a public opinion that says the President of the United States has violated federal law. Specter takes great pride in the fact that he was able to get the president to agree that he could be subject to some form of review. The interesting thing is that the Specter bill doesn't actually require the president to do it. It just says the president can do it. Well, you know what? In our system, he doesn't get to choose. These programs are already being reviewed by the courts.
Specter wrote that without knowing the exact contours of the NSA program, it's impossible to say whether the president is right or wrong when it comes to his authority, but that three federal appeals court decisions suggest that the president may be right. What's he talking about? Are the courts tending towards this expansion of presidential authority or against it?
No, those are decisions that spoke very generally about the president's inherent authority. But most of us do not believe that those are either controlling or in some cases relevant. I think what Senator Specter is trying to do is to say, I really didn't get snookered as much as people think I did. We could lose this. Well, you know, it's a very telling thing when not a single attorney involved in any of this litigation thinks that this is a good idea. All of them, as far as I know, have denounced it as a terrible mutation of our system. Part of our constitutional system requires a certain leap of faith. You don't know if you're going to win, but there's only one rule that is absolutely essential in a Madisonian democracy, and that is you let the federal courts decide. Sometimes you don't win, but you don't create secret courts where there's no opposing counsel and no meaningful appeal. That's not the rule of law. And I think the reason the White House wants this so desperately is that they're afraid that finally a court is going to say what many experts have said, that the president didn't have the authority and that he may have committed a crime over 30 times. And then people like Senator Spector are going to face questions of, why didn't you ever investigate whether the president committed crimes? And what have you been doing for the last few years?
All right. Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University.
What with plagiarism and fabrication and all, America has seen its share of unscrupulous journalism in recent years. But it's another thing to trade the power of the press for cold hard cash. Rare, but not unheard of, as we saw this year when New York Post scribe Jared Paul Stern was caught on tape trying to negotiate a financial deal with billionaire Ronald Burkle. Burkle had been badly treated by the Post's gossip page, and Stern hinted that some well-placed cash could improve the billionaire's press. Stern hasn't been charged, but if he committed blackmail, he didn't pioneer the practice. As Robert Love recalls in the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review, Stern has some seedy antecedents, including one Colonel William Dalton Mann, Civil War soldier, railroad car inventor, gossip hound.
Colonel Mann was the owner and publisher of a weekly newspaper called Town Topics, based in New York City, which he took over in 1891. And Town Topics was a kind of a gossip paper that chronicled the misdeeds of the Gilded Age robber barons and their families. He quickly turned it into a must-read. Everybody was dying to know what was going to be published in the next edition of Town Topics. So he became the steward of all of this information, much of it libelous or at least embarrassing.
Aha, but therein his great innovation, because he came up with what's called the blind item, which became a staple in gossip journalism. Tell me how a blind item works.
Well, a blind item works by printing all of the salacious details of somebody's deed, but leaving their name out of it, you know, which benefactor was seen winking at which model behind the scenes at a Democratic fundraiser or something of the sort.
And the further refinement of his blind items was that while the subject was anonymous in the item itself, elsewhere in the column, some names would show up, which were a form of code.
Well, Colonel Mann, who was an inventor before he was a publisher, invented this little Philip at the end of his blind items where he would actually then identify the person who was involved in the misdeed in a neutral way. But those who were in on the code, and it became clear pretty quickly, would know that old Creighton Webb was having his way with Mrs. Astor.
But then he figured out that as much value as there was in printing these items, there was even more profit to be had by not printing them.
And so what he did is he went to some of the wealthiest people in the world, Vanderbilts, J.P. Morgan, August Belmont, and he pretty much told them what he had. And he then asked them for money. Under the veil of buying stock in his company, he received the equivalent in today's dollars of millions of dollars from these men and from 50 other assorted, quote, immunes, as they were known, you know, whose reputations were kept sterling because they paid off Colonel Mann.
Well, it's sleazy, but enterprising.
It sure is.
The enterprise did not end in the 19th century. It popped up again in the 50s in a magazine called Confidential.
Tom Wolfe called Confidential the most scandalous scandal magazine in the history of the world. And for a while, it really was. It was the brainchild of a guy named Bob Harrison. He used to employ, you know, unemployed actors and down and outs and people from the service sector who had tales about Hollywood and gather the dirt on them that way. And his scheme was to turn sources by revealing things that he knew to them. So, for instance, Rock Hudson's marriage, which was a white marriage, as they call it, a marriage that was in name only because he was gay. He learned about this through a private detective, then took it to the head of the studio and basically turned that head of the studio into a source for Confidential magazine, in which another actor's past misdeeds, the unfortunate Rory Calhoun, were suddenly brought to attention in Confidential, his, quote, prison past.
So even if no money was exchanged, it was still extortion, only the payoff was in information.
That's right.
Now, the next guy holds a very special place in my heart because I grew up in Philadelphia and read many of his stories in the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he was just the absolute ace investigative reporter. His name was Harry Carafin.
Harry Carafin, I think you have to understand, was a true prince of the city in Philadelphia. He was able to get access to people at the highest level of government. He could go into municipal offices and riffle the files for material that he was looking for. So what he did, his operation was to identify people who were about to be, or companies that were about to be hit by police or the district attorney for fraud, and then he would offer his services to them to keep their names out of the paper or to write glowing articles about them.
It's amazing. But what's nearly as staggering is how he was his scheme was uncovered by another pair of investigative reporters who somehow realized that they weren't getting scooped anymore by Harry Carafin, and they wondered what was up.
Right. There were two investigative reporters for Philadelphia Magazine, which was a very low-budget local magazine at the time, and they kept running into Carafin's trails. And sources would tell them, well, you better not publish this because, you know, Carafin's at a daily, and he's going to obviously scoop you guys. But the stories never appeared, and there was their aha moment. And so began the kind of unraveling of Harry Carafin's six-year run of enriching himself, you know, using the power of Walter Annenberg's Philadelphia Inquirer.
Now, the premise of this piece is that these guys are rare birds. How do we really know that there aren't Harry Carafins lurking in every city in America?
In the research that I've done, it seemed clear to me that although there is a potential in every journalistic transaction for enrichment for the reporters, it just doesn't happen on this level. I think one has to assume that you would hear about it.
Well, that seems like a reasonable answer. Now, I just can tell you, for $500, we'll run this interview. For $1,000, we'll kill it.
Let's run it.
Robert Love is an adjunct professor at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. His piece titled Shakedown appears in the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review.
Coming up, a new TV news anchor cuts no ice in the land of nice, and how not to interview celebrities.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There's something comforting about local news, and that's by design. It's weather, it's news you can use, it's high school sports. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, the NBC affiliate, that's KARE-TV or CARE, has been the undisputed king of news with a homespun spin for years. Until now. CARE has lost the top spot to the CBS affiliate. Their new anchor, or family member, as they call him, isn't resonating with the viewers, who aren't sure he's Minnesota Nice, as Sarah Lemanchek reports.
He has family here in Minnesota. He loves to fish and was once drafted by the Minnesota Twins. So
Mike Pomerantz arrived in January from New York City with a media blitz.
Lutefisk.
Yeah, lutefisk.
Care11's new anchor, Mike Pomerantz, speaks fluent Minnesotan, hot dishes and all.
My mother-in-law makes the type with those perfectly aligned tater tots.
Other cities might drool over getting such a number one prospect. But in Minnesota, Miami-born good looks, dark hair, and big city experience, not necessarily assets.
He's an outsider.
To say nothing of that cock-of-the-walk smile he wears.
CJ's the gossip columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. If there's one voice that knows all the secrets, dirty, little, and otherwise, about the local media, it's CJ. She knew Pomerantz was on his way before Care had finished pushing its old anchor out the door. But if there's one thing that she dislikes more than the way Mike Pomerantz was hired, it's the way he smiles.
Cheesy. I'm thinking super white cheddar. We like a certain humanness, a realness, a sincerity. This guy's not sincere.
Care took pains to show us just how sincere and Minnesotan Mike really is. We saw wedding photos. We saw home video from the lake. We saw his daughter sledding. We saw Mike as a young Turk in his Minnesota Twins jersey. It's like watching Cliff's Notes on how to be Minnesotan. Mike, Kerr said, even had fish cred.
Wife Laura grew up in Bloomington, went to Thomas Jefferson High, and is an avid angler.
And they'll right away go to me and say, oh, you caught this, it's wonderful, and blah, 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 blah. And I'll say, no, my wife caught that. That's my wife's walleye.
Mike Pomerantz has to establish that Minnesota connection.
Sherry Mazingo is the Kohl's Media Fellow at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism.
That connection that says, I am one of you, when he gives the news. It doesn't just work to show, you know, background footage of Pomerantz holding a fish.
She believes that being Minnesotan is more than sharing a zip code. It's a commitment, which is why many anchors stick around for 20 or 30 years. Gossip columnist CJ agrees.
We like our own. That's the first thing. So if you're not, if you weren't from here, you have to let us come to accept you. I don't have problems with diversity and ethnicity, but some of us do in Minnesota.
We run a tight ship here in Minnesota. Even flashy shoes can be considered diverse, as can undue gestures or standing too close. To fit in, you need, at the very least, to know how to speak Minnesotan, as in knowing the right nicknames for the Twins.
If you'd been a smart prospect, he wouldn't have come to town as the anchorman and started referring to them as the Twinkies. They don't like to be called the Twinkies, and Minnesotans only call them the Twinkies when they're messing up. It's not a term of endearment. I don't think he knows that.
What he does know is hard news. There isn't a journalist in town who is anywhere near his credentials. Unfortunately, Mike's experience has prepared him for a different type of news.
I find the quality of life here so laughably high in a way. You're going, you mean to tell me we had to go 50 miles to find a shooting? You know, a gang-related shooting? Not that you don't feel bad for the victims, but really, what does that tell you? Where I'm from, professionally, you better have some chops. With this market, it's, hey, I'm part of this organization and that organization. Oh, I've never covered anything, but I do like children, and I never kick puppies, and I also finger paint, and sometimes I like meeting people. You know, I mean, it's a different approach.
There's something about Mike's direct gaze, his erect and imposing posture, and non-nasaled vowels that's unsettling in a market where sports reporting occasionally contains skits. Sherry Mazingo.
I think the other markets, particularly the larger markets, they're looking for more sophistication in anchors. They're looking for more of a smartness, if you will. Mike Pomerantz on air seems like a fish out of water.
I know that you're thinking, well, we want to, you know, my gosh, the numbers, the ratings, the gossip columnists. You know what? It's crap. It's all crap. It doesn't even matter. What matters is what folks start to see night in and night out. If they don't like what they're seeing, they're going to keep letting me know. And the next time you and I talk, I'll be in San Francisco.
Which is a shame because in person, he really is genuine. Even CJ says that if the station fired him now, it just wouldn't seem caring.
If you wanted this boy, you got this boy. Play him.
Because if there's one thing that concerns us Minnesotans more than insincerity, its unfairness. It's just not Minnesota nice. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Lemanchek. Pleasing your audience can be tough, especially if you have a particularly demanding audience of one. That's the biggest hurdle faced by celebrity interviewers. Rock stars and A-list actors can be impenetrable fortresses, but Jancy Dunn knows how to break down their barricades. As a long-standing Rolling Stone interviewer and erstwhile MTV VJ, she's penned a sort of field manual of tactics for teasing out that crucial quote. It's also a personal memoir, a tribute to New Jersey, and a heap of delicious dish called But Enough About Me, A Jersey Girl's Unlikely Adventures Among the Absurdly Famous. Jancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So your book actually is part memoir and part how-to, and both parts, by the way, are brilliant and hilarious. But for our show, it makes sense to focus on the how-to part. Specifically, how to or how not to interview famous people. Your opening chapter is called How to Jolly Up a Surly Hungover Band During an Interview. You're meeting them in the morning after show, and what?
I was both a reporter for Rolling Stone and a VJ on MTV2, and they would schedule these interviews that I would have with musicians in the morning, which is not musician hour, you know, at 10 a.m. And they would roll in and I would know immediately if it was going to be a disaster because the lead singer would have sunglasses on indoors or they would smell like vomit and I'd know that they'd thrown up outside. That happened a lot. I really did start carrying Tic Tacs. And I had to devise a plan to get them to wake up and give me good quotes. And the system that I devised works 100% of the time. And it is when they roll in and they can't be bothered. And another thing is that they have to pretend like it doesn't matter to them that they're being interviewed by Rolling Stone or MTV, because that's not very rock,
right?
To act like you're excited, right? So you have to be jaded and take it out on the VJ or the writer. So I would always pay attention to the drummer. I practically sat in his lap and I would roar with laughter at every mild joke that he made, like, wah, ah, ah, you know, and I would ask him about his drumming philosophies. They often have one or two. And
you mentioned one of them. Oh, that's amazing. I never thought of it before, but drumming is a metaphor for life.
I have said that before. I'm not proud, but I have said that before with a big smile on my face. The drummer is puzzled at first, maybe a little suspicious, but then he can't help but blossom under your tender gaze, your hyena-like laughter. And then eventually the rest of the bandmates start jostling because they can't stand it. They're hostile. Then they're eager to give you the quotes about groupies and drugs and anything else that you need. And then, of course, when you've left and you're putting the interview together, you don't use any quotes from the drummer. Come on.
One of my favorite chapters in the book is don't get down with the rhythm and blues people if you're the whitest person in the world.
There's this classic thing at Rolling Stone where there was one staffer that said to Queen Latifah, "Yo, Queen, where'd you get your bag?" And she said, I got it at Bergdorf's. You should always be yourself.
And you mostly were, except with Destiny's Child.
Right. Oh, you led into that smoothly, didn't you, Brooke? You got me. I definitely enhanced my religious faith because when I met up with them, they invoked the Lord in every other sentence. So I started bringing up the Lord too. And suddenly I was Billy Graham and I really went nuts. And when I was a kid, I was dragged to Bible school so I could remember certain verses. And at the end of it, I can remember to my everlasting shame, they were testifying about something. They were talking about how the Lord would provide or the Lord was going to do something. I forget what it was. But they were all holding up their testifying hands and I too held up my hand.
But for the most part, it strikes me that where you went right with most of these people is that you really did stay yourself. You didn't embarrass them by trying to be one of them.
No. It would be such a mistake to even attempt to pretend. You know, I've interviewed really hardcore rappers and R&B stars. And, you know, at first I tried to be D-O-W and it just doesn't work. And when I was myself, I found that they really did respond to me better because you don't have to be exactly alike. The contrast sometimes works. And at the same time, I also didn't do that. I have a funkiness deficiency. You'll have to help me out here. You know, that goes wrong too. You know, I was just myself. It wasn't always a smash success, but sometimes it did work nicely.
Now, a lot of your interviewing do's and don'ts derive from a keen understanding of human nature. For instance, the power of first impressions or what not to say when you're meeting somebody. So could you give me some examples of classic deadly openers?
Oh, I'm a big fan of yours. Oh, that's a killer. I loved your film. So did 300,000 other people. They've heard it 50 times a day by people who stop them in the street. So I've learned the hard way that anything that starts with the word I, even if it's I didn't kill myself because I listened to your album, their eyes glaze over. They do not care.
Unless you say, I was having sex the first time I heard your album. You said that
yes,
one's okay.
I did. I said that to... I hope my folks aren't listening, but I did say that to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin, and it was in fact true. I won't even name the song. It's too sordid, but you know, they perked right up. But that was the only time I bent my rule and led off the proceedings with the word I.
So we've talked about the psychology of the host, but what about your psychology, Jancy? I mean, what happens when your editor wants you to ask that question that you would rather die than ask? How do you find the courage or temerity to ask the question that you hate?
Oh, Brooke, if it takes place in a restaurant, which often, of course, it does, I have made the mistake of asking the painful question before the check comes, and if the person freaks out on you, then the wait for the check is long and very tense. So I really do always try to ask at the very end, and I'm not fooling anyone, and I always blame my editor. I really don't want to ask about, you know, that prostitute, but my editor wants to know, what can I say? For instance, Kelly Ripa of Live with Regis and...
Uh-huh.
I had to ask her for Red Book magazine, of all places, if she and her husband used sex toys, and if so, which ones? Can you imagine?
For Red Book?
Red Book? What's that about? And she turned bright lobster red, and she was really embarrassed. I mean, she's kind of an old-fashioned girl. And at least I was by the door when I asked, and I immediately said, oh, thanks a lot. Okay, see you later. Bye. And I ran out of there. Of course, she talked about me the next day on the air. That was mortifying. I did a spit take into my coffee.
Well, then how embarrassed could she have really been?
That's true. I mean, just like me, she was using everything for material. It's all sausage, right? It all goes somewhere.
Now, you faced the situation with Ben Affleck when his breakup with Jennifer Lopez was still raw and you were there to talk about something else, but you had to ask this question.
Well, this was to promote his short-lived movie Jersey Girl, directed by Kevin Smith, and we were putting him on the cover of Rolling Stone, ostensibly because of this movie, but of course it was post-breakup and it was very convenient. And his publicist had said, do not ask about Jennifer Lopez. He is not going to answer. But that's the whole reason I was going out there. So I was extremely nervous. And we met at his office and he was not in a good mood. And usually he is an interviewer's dream. He's very quippy. He's very funny. He really labors to give you that good quote. But he had his arms folded and he was very brittle and he was barking out his answers. And so I said, listen, do you want to talk about the breakup with Jennifer? You know, my editor's making me, you know, I blame the editor again. And he floated a theory that the media were complicit in the breakup. And I said, oh, really? How so? And he said, well, they just absolutely followed our every move and we didn't have a chance, our relationship. I mean, I didn't want to say, but every time you turn around there, they were making out with each other on the red carpet, you know, and she was frying up chicken on the television show. And so I started to sweat because we got in an argument, but I kept saying, you really were participants in this. And he said, that's not true. And I'm going to prove it to you. He grabbed his keys and we hopped into his BMW and he said, let's go get a taco and I'm going to show you what happens. We went to this place called Poquito Mas in Los Angeles. Very good tacos, by the way. And within 3 minutes of me getting my veg burrito, the paparazzi converged.
And he egged them on. He told you to hide your tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
He hugged you and whispered something funny in your ear so that you would laugh. And those pictures were taken. And when you got back to Rolling Stone.
they were all over the wires the next day. There was a bidding war among the tabloids, and the winning tabloid bought them for $11,000. And what he was whispering in my ear was, "You're really stiff. You got to look like you like me," you know, because I was very nervous because his arm was around me. And what was funny is every time that I pretended like I didn't want the photographers to take a picture of me, I would kind of shrink away with my tray of tacos. They were all over me. So it was very telling. And he made his point in a very interesting way.
Doesn't that support the argument that maybe we should not feed this appetite for intimacy that is created by countless articles and stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, I have felt...
Do you hate yourself?
Yeah. Well, I was about to say self-loathing was the term I was going to use. Yes, of course. In my off hours, I certainly don't read any of that stuff. I don't watch any of those television shows. It is truly what I do for a living, and that's it.
But that's the question, you see. You've been able to, in a sense, OD on it. But I still read that stuff.
Do you?
Sure. You had a conversation with Robert Downey. I've never met Robert Downey, but I kind of feel like I know him, and I read your conversation.
Well, at this point, I feel like with celebrity journalism that we really are one giant high school, and they're the cool kids, and everyone on the internet can comment on them, can envy them, despise them, emulate them. So I understand why you feel a familiarity with him.
Public radio is populated almost entirely by the high school nerds, so maybe it's even more intense for that reason.
That makes sense. Well, Rolling Stone, too. I mean, everybody was a card-carrying former nerd, you know, carefully disguised. But mutton chop sideburns can't disguise, you know, the inner nerd.
Jancy, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure.
Jancy Dunn, Rolling Stone interviewer extraordinaire, is the author of But Enough About Me, A Jersey Girl's Unlikely Adventures Among the Absurdly Famous.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had extra engineering help from Rob Christensen and other assistants from Claire Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On August 2nd, Live from Lincoln Center broadcast the Mostly Mozart Festival opening night gala, featuring Maestro Louis Longre, the Mostly Mozart Festival Orchestra, and Garrick Olson. Check out local PBS listings. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.